La Vie en Rose? The entrance to the Roi Galant was a 7-foot golden picture frame, which had once, perhaps, enclosed the vast portrait of a noble European. It was in a discreet corner of the kitchen, the public roulette and ballroom, where several tables were still busy. As Bond took Vespa's arm and led her over the gilded step, he fought back a hankering to borrow some money from the caisse and plaster maximums over the nearest table. But he knew that this would be a brash and cheap gesture, pour épater la bourgeoisie. Whether he won or lost, it would be a kick in the teeth to the luck which had been given him. The nightclub was small and dark, lit only by candles in gilded candelabra, whose warm light was repeated in wall mirrors set in more gold picture frames. The walls were covered in dark red satin, and the chairs and banquette in matching red plush. In the far corner, a trio consisting of a piano, an electric guitar and drums was playing La Vie en Rose with muted sweetness. Seduction dripped on the quietly throbbing air. It seemed to Bond that every couple must be touching with passion under the tables. They were given a corner table near the door. Bond ordered a bottle of Veuve Clicquot and scrambled eggs and bacon. They sat for a time listening to the music, and then Bond turned to Vespa. "It's wonderful sitting here with you and knowing the job's finished. It's a lovely end to the day. The prize-giving." He expected her to smile. She said, "Yes, isn't it?" in a rather brittle voice. She seemed to be listening carefully to the music. One elbow rested on the table and her hand supported her chin, but on the back of her hand and not on the palm, and Bond noticed that her knuckles showed white as if her fist was tightly clenched. Between the thumb and first two fingers of her right hand, she held one of Bond's cigarettes, as an artist holds a crayon, and though she smoked with composure, she tapped the cigarette occasionally into an ashtray when the cigarette had no ash. Bond noticed these small things because he felt intensely aware of her, and because he wanted to draw her into his own feeling of warmth and relaxed sensuality. But he accepted her reserve. He thought it came from a desire to protect herself from him, or else it was her reaction to his coolness to her earlier in the evening, his deliberate coolness, which he knew had been taken as a rebuff. He was patient. He drank champagne and talked a little about the happenings of the day and about the personalities of Matisse and Leiter and about the possible consequences for Le Chiffre. He was discreet, and he only talked about the aspects of the case on which she must have been briefed by London. She answered perfunctorily. She said that, of course, they had picked out the two gunmen, but had thought nothing of it when the man with the stick had gone to stand behind Bond's chair. They could not believe that anything would be attempted in the casino itself. Directly Bond and Leiter had left to walk over to the hotel, she had telephoned Paris and told M's representative of the result of the game. She had had to speak guardedly, and the agent had rung off without comment. She had been told to do this, whatever the result. M had asked for the information to be passed on to him personally, at any time of the day or night. This was all she said. She sipped at her champagne and rarely glanced at Bond. She didn't smile. Bond felt frustrated. He drank a lot of champagne and ordered another bottle. The scrambled eggs came and they ate in silence. At 4 o'clock, Bond was about to call for the bill when the maitre d'hôtel appeared at their table and inquired for Miss Lind. He handed her a note, which she took and read hastily. "Oh, it's only Matisse," she said. "He says would I come to the entrance hall. He's got a message for you. Perhaps he's not in evening clothes or something. I won't be a minute. Then perhaps we could go home." She gave him a strained smile. "I'm afraid I don't feel very good company this evening. It's been rather a nerve-wracking day. I'm so sorry." Bond made a perfunctory reply and rose, pushing back the table. "I'll get the bill," he said, and watched her take the few steps to the entrance. He sat down and lit a cigarette. He felt flat. He suddenly realized that he was tired. The stuffiness of the room hit him, as it had hit him in the casino in the early hours of the previous day. He called for the bill and took a last mouthful of champagne. It tasted bitter, as the first glass too many always does. He would have liked to have seen Matisse's cheerful face and heard his news, perhaps even a word of congratulation. Suddenly, the note to Vesper seemed odd to him. It was not the way Matisse would do things. He would have asked them both to join him at the bar of the casino, or he would have joined them in the nightclub, whatever his clothes. They would have laughed together, and Matisse would have been excited. He had much to tell Bond, more than Bond had to tell him. The arrest of the Bulgarian, who had probably talked some more, the chase after the man with a stick, Le Chiffre's movements when he left the casino. Bond shook himself. He hastily paid the bill, not waiting for the change. He pushed back his table and walked quickly through the entrance without acknowledging the good nights of the maitre d'hotel and the doorman. He hurried through the gaming room and looked carefully up and down the long entrance hall. He cursed and quickened his step. There were only one or two officials and two or three men and women in evening clothes getting their things at the vestiaire. No Vesper, no Matisse. He was almost running. He got to the entrance and looked along the steps to left and right, down and amongst the few remaining cars. The commissionaire came towards him. A taxi, monsieur? Bond waved him aside and started down the steps, his eyes staring into the shadows, the night air cold on his sweating temples. He was halfway down when he heard a faint cry, then the slam of a door away to the right. With a harsh growl and stutter from the exhaust, a beetle-browed Citroën shot out of the shadows into the light of the moon, its front-wheel drive dry-skidding through the loose pebbles of the forecourt. Its tail rocked on its soft springs, as if a violent struggle was taking place on the back seat. With a snarl, it raced out to the wide entrance gate in a spray of gravel. A small black object shot out of an open rear window and thudded into a flowerbed. There was a scream of tortured rubber as the tyres caught the boulevard in a harsh left-handed turn, the deafening echo of a Citroën's exhaust in second gear, a crash into top, then a swiftly diminishing crackle as the car haired off between the shops on the main street towards the coast road. Bond knew he would find Vesper's evening bag among the flowers. He ran back with it across the gravel to the brightly lit steps and scrabbled through its contents while the commissionaire hovered round him. The crumpled note was there amongst the usual feminine baggage. "Can you come out to the entrance hall for a moment? I have news for your companion, René Matisse." Chapter 15. Black Hair and Grey Hound. It was the crudest possible forgery. Bond leapt for the Bentley, blessing the impulse which had made him drive it over after dinner. With the choke full out, the engine answered at once to the starter, and the roar drowned the faltering words of the commissionaire, who jumped aside as the rear wheels whipped gravel at his piped trouser legs. As the car rocked to the left outside the gate, Bond ruefully longed for the front-wheel drive and low chassis of the Citroën. Then he went fast through the gears and settled himself for the pursuit, briefly savouring the echo of the huge exhaust as it came back at him from either side of the short main street through the town. Soon he was out on the coast road, a broad highway through the sand dunes, which he knew from his morning's drive had an excellent surface and was well cat's-eyed on the bends. He pushed the revs up and up, hurrying the car to 80, then to 90, his huge Marshall headlights boring a safe white tunnel nearly half a mile long between the walls of the night. He knew the Citroën must have come this way. He had heard the exhaust penetrate beyond the town, and a little dust still hung on the bends. He hoped soon to see the distant shaft of its headlights. The night was still and clear. Only out at sea there must be a light summer mist, for at intervals he could hear the foghorns lowing like iron cattle down the coast. As he drove, whipping the car faster and faster through the night, with the other half of his mind he cursed Vesper and M for having sent her on the job. This was just what he had been afraid of. These blithering women who thought they could do a man's work, why the hell couldn't they stay at home and mind their pots and pans and stick to their frocks and gossip and leave men's work to the men? And now for this to happen to him, just when the job had come off so beautifully. For Vesper to fall for an old trick like that, and get herself snatched and probably held to ransom like some bloody heroine in a strip cartoon. The silly bitch. Bond boiled at the thought of the fix he was in. Of course, the idea was a straight swap. The girl against his cheque for 40 million. Well, he wouldn't play. Wouldn't think of playing. She was in the service and knew what she was up against. He wouldn't even ask M. The job was more important than her. It was just too bad. She was a fine girl, but he wasn't going to fall for this childish trick. No dice. He would try and catch the citron and shoot it out with them, and if she got shot in the process, that was too bad too. He would have done his stuff, tried to rescue her before they got her off to some hideout. But if he didn't catch up with them, he would get back to his hotel and go to sleep and say no more about it. The next morning he would ask Matisse what had happened to her and show him the note. If Le Chiffre put the touch on Bond for the money in exchange for the girl, Bond would do nothing and tell no one. The girl would just have to take it. If the commissionaire came along with the story of what he had seen, Bond would bluff it out by saying he had had a drunken row with the girl. Bond's mind raged furiously on with the problem as he flung the great car down the coast road, automatically taking the curves and watching out for carts or cyclists on their way into Royale. On straight stretches, the Amherst Villa's supercharger dug spurs into the Bentley's 25 horses, and the engine sent a high-pitched scream of pain into the night. Then the revolutions mounted until he was past 110 and on to the 120 miles per hour mark on the speedometer. He knew he must be gaining fast. Loaded as she was, the Citroën could hardly better 80, even on this road. On an impulse, he slowed down to 70, turned on his fog lights, and doused the twin Marshalls. Sure enough, without the blinding curtain of his own lights, he could see the glow of another car a mile or two down the coast. He felt under the dashboard and from a concealed holster took out a long-barreled Colt Army Special .45 and laid it on the seat beside him. With this, if he was lucky with the surface of the road, he could hope to get their tyres or their petrol tank at anything up to 100 yards. Then he switched on the big lights again and screamed off in pursuit. He felt calm and at ease. The problem of Vespa's life was a problem no longer. His face in the blue light from the dashboard was grim but serene. Ahead in the Citroën there were three men and the girl. Le Chiffre was driving, his big, fluid body hunched forward, his hands light and delicate on the wheel. Beside him sat the squat man who had carried the stick in the casino. In his left hand he grasped a thick lever which protruded beside him almost level with the floor. It might have been a lever to adjust the driving seat. In the back seat was the tall, thin gunman. He lay back, relaxed, gazing at the ceiling, apparently uninterested in the wild speed of the car. His right hand lay caressingly on Vespa's left thigh, which stretched out naked beside him. Apart from her legs, which were naked to the hips, Vespa was only a parcel. Her long black velvet skirt had been lifted over her arms and head and tied above her head with a piece of rope. Where her face was, a small gap had been torn in the velvet so that she could breathe. She was not bound in any other way, and she lay quiet, her body moving sluggishly with the swaying of the car. Le Chiffre was concentrating half on the road ahead and half on the onrushing glare of Bond's headlights in the driving mirror. He seemed undisturbed when not more than a mile separated the hare from the hounds, and he even brought the car down from 80 to 60 miles an hour. Now, as he swept round a bend, he slowed down still further. A few hundred yards ahead, a Michelin post showed where a small parochial road crossed with the highway.
"Attention,"
he said sharply to the man beside him. The man's hand tightened on the lever. 100 yards from the crossroads, he slowed to 30. In the mirror, Bond's great headlights were lighting up the bend. Le Chiffre seemed to make up his mind.
"Allez."
The man beside him pulled the lever sharply upwards. The boot at the back of the car yawned open like a whale's mouth. There was a tinkling clatter on the road, and then a rhythmic jangling as if the car was towing lengths of chain behind it.
"Coupé."
The man depressed the lever sharply, and the jangling stopped with a final clatter. Le Chiffre glanced again in the mirror. Bond's car was just entering the bend. Le Chiffre made a racing change and threw the Citroën left-handed down the narrow side road, at the same time dousing his lights. He stopped the car with a jerk, and all three men got swiftly out and doubled back under cover of a low hedge to the crossroads, now fiercely illuminated by the lights of the Bentley. Each of them carried a revolver, and the thin man also had what looked like a large black egg in his right hand. The Bentley screamed down towards them like an express train. Chapter 16. The Crawling of the Skin. As Bond hurtled round the bend, caressing the great car against the camber with an easy sway of body and hands, he was working out his plan of action when the distance between the two cars had narrowed still further. He imagined that the enemy driver would try to dodge off into a side road if he got the chance. So when he got round the bend and saw no lights ahead, it was a normal reflex to ease up on the accelerator, and when he saw the Michelin post, to prepare to brake. He was only doing about 60 as he approached the black patch across the right-hand crown of the road, which he assumed to be the shadow cast by a wayside tree. Even so, there was no time to save himself. There was suddenly a small carpet of glinting steel spikes right under his offside wing. Then he was on top of it. Bond automatically slammed the brakes full on and braced all his sinews against the wheel to correct the inevitable sharp slew to the left, but he only kept control for a split second. As the rubber was flayed from his offside wheels and the rims for an instant tore up the tarmac, the heavy car whirled across the road in a tearing dry skid, slammed the left bank with a crash that knocked Bond out of the driving seat onto the floor, and then, facing back up the road, it reared slowly up, its front wheels spinning and its great headlights searching the sky. For a split second, resting on the petrol tank, it seemed to paw at the heavens like a giant praying mantis. Then, slowly, it toppled over backwards and fell with a splintering crash of coachwork and glass. In the deafening silence, the near-side front wheel whispered briefly on and then squeaked to a stop. Le Chiffre and his two men only had to walk a few yards from their ambush.
"Put your guns away and get him out," he ordered brusquely. "I'll keep you covered. Be careful of him. I don't want a corpse. And hurry up. It's getting light."
The two men got down on their knees. One of them took out a long knife and cut some of the fabric away from the side of the convertible hood and took hold of Bond's shoulders. He was unconscious and immovable. The other squeezed between the upturned car and the bank and forced his way through the crumpled window frame. He eased Bond's legs, pinned between the steering wheel and the fabric roof of the car. Then they inched him out through a hole in the hood. They were sweating and filthy with dust and oil by the time they had him lying in the road. The thin man felt his heart and then slapped his face hard on either side. Bond grunted and moved a hand. The thin man slapped him again.
"That's enough," said Le Chiffre. "Tie his arms and put him in the car. Here."
He threw a roll of flex to the man.
"Empty his pockets first and give me his gun. He may have got some other weapons, but we can get them later."
He took the objects the thin man handed him and stuffed them and Bond's beretta into his wide pockets without examining them. He left the men to it and walked back to the car. His face showed neither pleasure nor excitement. It was the sharp bite of the wire flex into his wrists that brought Bond to himself. He was aching all over as if he had been thrashed with a wooden club, but when he was yanked to his feet and pushed towards the narrow side road where the engine of the Citroën was already running softly, he found that no bones were broken. But he felt in no mood for desperate attempts to escape, and allowed himself to be dragged into the back seat of the car without resisting. He felt thoroughly dispirited and weak in resolve as well as in his body. He had had to take too much in the past 24 hours, and now this last stroke by the enemy seemed almost too final. This time there could be no miracles. No one knew where he was, and no one would miss him until well on into the morning. The wreck of his car would be found before very long, but it would take hours to trace the ownership to him. And Vespa. He looked to the right, past the thin man who was lying back with his eyes closed. His first reaction was one of scorn. Damn fool girl getting herself trussed up like a chicken, having her skirt pulled over her head as if the whole of this business was some kind of dormitory rag. But then he felt sorry for her. Her naked legs looked so childlike and defenceless.
"Vespa," he said softly.
There was no answer from the bundle in the corner, and Bond suddenly had a chill feeling. But then she stirred slightly. At the same time, the thin man caught him a hard, backhanded blow over the heart.
"Silence!"
Bond doubled over with the pain, and to shield himself from another blow, only to get a rabbit punch on the back of the neck, which made him arch back again, the breath whistling through his teeth. The thin man had hit him a hard, professional, cutting blow with the edge of the hand. There was something rather deadly about his accuracy and lack of effort. He was now again lying back, his eyes closed. He was a man to make you afraid, an evil man. Bond hoped he might get a chance of killing him. Suddenly the boot of the car was thrown open and there was a clanking crash. Bond guessed that they had been waiting for the third man to retrieve the carpet of spiked chain mail. He assumed it must be an adaptation of the nail-studded devices used by the resistance against German staff cars. Again, he reflected on the efficiency of these people and the ingenuity of the equipment they used. Had M underestimated their resourcefulness? He stifled a desire to place the blame on London. It was he who should have known. He who should have been warned by small signs and taken infinitely more precautions. He squirmed as he thought of himself washing down champagne in the Roi Galant while the enemy was busy preparing his counterstroke. He cursed himself, and cursed the hubris which had made him so sure that the battle was won and the enemy in flight. All this time, Le Chiffre had said nothing. Directly the boot was shut, the third man, whom Bond at once recognised, climbed in beside him, and Le Chiffre reversed furiously back onto the main road. Then he banged the gear lever through the gate and was soon doing 70 on down the coast. By now it was dawn, about 5 o'clock, Bond guessed, and he reflected that a mile or two on was the turning to Le Chiffre's villa. He had not thought that they would take Vesper there. Now that he realised that Vesper had only been a sprat to catch a mackerel, the whole picture became clear. It was an extremely unpleasant picture. For the first time since his capture, fear came to Bond and crawled up his spine. 10 minutes later, the Citroën lurched to the left, ran on a few hundred yards up a small side road partly overgrown with grass, and then between a pair of dilapidated stucco pillars into an unkempt forecourt surrounded by a high wall. They drew up in front of a peeling white door. Above a rusty bell push in the doorframe, small zinc letters on a wooden base spelled out Les Noctambules, and underneath, Sonnez, s'il vous plaît. From what Bond could see of the cement frontage, the villa was typical of the French seaside style. He could imagine the dead blue bottles being hastily swept out for the summer let, and the stale rooms briefly aired by a cleaning woman sent by the estate agent in Royale. Every 5 years, one coat of whitewash would be slapped over the rooms and the outside woodwork, and for a few weeks the villa would present a smiling front to the world. Then the winter rains would get to work, and the imprisoned flies, and quickly the villa would take on again its abandoned look. But, Bond reflected, it would admirably serve Le Chiffre's purpose this morning, if he was right in assuming what that was to be. They had passed no other house since his capture, and from his reconnaissance of the day before he knew there was only an occasional farm for several miles to the south. As he was urged out of the car with a sharp crack in the ribs from the thin man's elbow, he knew that Le Chiffre could have them both to himself, undisturbed, for several hours. Again, his skin crawled. Le Chiffre opened the door with a key and disappeared inside. Vesper, looking incredibly indecent in the early light of day, was pushed in after him with a torrent of lewd French from the man whom Bond knew to himself as the Corsican. Bond followed without giving the thin man a chance to urge him. The key of the front door turned in the lock. Le Chiffre was standing in the doorway of a room on the right. He crooked a finger at Bond in a silent, spidery summons. Vesper was being led down a passage towards the back of the house. Bond suddenly decided. With a wild backward kick which connected with the thin man's shins and brought a whistle of pain from him, he hurled himself down the passage after her. With only his feet as weapons, there was no plan in his mind except to do as much damage as possible to the two gunmen and be able to exchange a few hurried words with the girl. No other plan was possible. He just wanted to tell her not to give in. As the Corsican turned at the commotion, Bond was on him, and his right shoe was launched in a flying kick at the other man's groin. Like lightning, the Corsican slammed himself back against the wall of the passage, and as Bond's foot whistled past his hip, he very quickly, but somehow delicately, shot out his left hand, caught Bond's shoe at the top of its arc, and twisted it sharply. Completely off balance, Bond's other foot left the ground. In the air, his whole body turned, and with the momentum of his rush behind it, crashed sideways and down onto the floor. For a moment he lay there, all the breath knocked out of him. Then the thin man came and hauled him up against the wall by his collar. He had a gun in his hand. He looked Bond inquisitively in the eyes. Then, unhurriedly, he bent down and swiped the barrel viciously across Bond's shins. Bond grunted and caved at the knees.
"If there is a next time, It will be across your teeth, said the thin man in bad French.
A door slammed. Vesper and the Corsican had disappeared. Bond turned his head to the right. Le Chiffre had moved a few feet out into the passage. He lifted his finger and crooked it again. Then, for the first time, he spoke.
Come, my dear friend. We are wasting our time.
He spoke in English with no accent. His voice was low and soft and unhurried. He showed no emotion. He might have been a doctor summoning the next patient from the waiting room, a hysterical patient who had been expostulating feebly with a nurse. Bond again felt puny and impotent. Nobody but an expert in jiu-jitsu could have handled him with the Corsican's economy and lack of fuss. The cold precision with which the thin man had paid him back in his own coin had been equally unhurried, even artistic. Almost docilely, Bond walked back down the passage. He had nothing but a few more bruises to show for his clumsy gesture of resistance to these people. As he preceded the thin man over the threshold, he knew that he was utterly and absolutely in their power. Chapter 17. My Dear Boy. It was a large bare room, sparsely furnished in cheap French Art Nouveau style. It was difficult to say whether it was intended as a living or dining room, for a flimsy-looking mirrored sideboard, sporting an orange crackleware fruit dish and two painted wooden candlesticks, took up most of the wall opposite the door and contradicted the faded pink sofa ranged against the other side of the room. There was no table in the centre under the alabasterine ceiling light, only a small square of stained carpet with a futurist design in contrasting browns. Over by the window was an incongruous-looking throne-like chair in carved oak with a red velvet seat, a low table on which stood an empty water carafe and two glasses, and a light armchair with a round cane seat and no cushion. Half-closed Venetian blinds obscured the view from the window, but cast bars of early sunlight over the few pieces of furniture and over part of the brightly papered wall and the brown-stained floorboards. Le Chiffre pointed at the cane chair.
That will do excellently, he said to the thin man. Prepare him quickly. If he resists, damage him only a little.
He turned to Bond. There was no expression on his large face, and his round eyes were uninterested.
Take off your clothes. For every effort to resist, Basil will break one of your fingers. We are serious people, and your good health is of no interest to us. Whether you live or die depends on the outcome of the talk we are about to have.
He made a gesture towards the thin man and left the room. The thin man's first action was a curious one. He opened the clasp knife he had used on the hood of Bond's car, took the small armchair, and with a swift motion he cut out its cane seat. Then he came back to Bond, sticking the still-open knife like a fountain pen in the vest pocket of his coat. He turned Bond round to the light and unwound the flex from his wrists. Then he stood quickly aside, and the knife was back in his right hand.
Vite!
Bond stood chafing his swollen wrists and debating with himself how much time he could waste by resisting. He only delayed an instant. With a swift step and a downward sweep of his free hand, the thin man seized the collar of his dinner jacket and dragged it down, pinning Bond's arms back. Bond made the traditional counter to this old policeman's hold by dropping down on one knee, but as he dropped, the thin man dropped with him and at the same time brought his knife round and down behind Bond's back. Bond felt the back of the blade pass down his spine. There was the hiss of a sharp knife through cloth, and his arms were suddenly free as the two halves of his coat fell forward. He cursed and stood up. The thin man was back in his previous position, his knife again at the ready in his relaxed hand. Bond let the two halves of his dinner jacket fall off his arms onto the floor.
Allez,
said the thin man with a faint trace of impatience. Bond looked him in the eye, and then slowly started to take off his shirt. Le Chiffre came quietly back into the room. He carried a pot of what smelt like coffee. He put it on the small table near the window. He also placed beside it on the table two other homely objects, a 3-foot-long carpet beater in twisted cane, and a carving knife. He settled himself comfortably on the throne-like chair and poured some of the coffee into one of the glasses. With one foot he hooked forward the small armchair, whose seat was now an empty circular frame of wood, until it was directly opposite him. Bond stood stark naked in the middle of the room, bruises showing livid on his white body, his face a grey mask of exhaustion and knowledge of what was to come.
"Sit down there."
Le Chiffre nodded at the chair in front of him. Bond walked over and sat down. The thin man produced some flex. With this he bound Bond's wrists to the arms of the chair and his ankles to the front legs. He passed a double strand across his chest, under the armpits, and through the chair back. He made no mistakes with the knots and left no play in any of the bindings. All of them bit sharply into Bond's flesh. The legs of the chair were broadly spaced, and Bond could not even rock it. He was utterly a prisoner, naked and defenceless. His buttocks and the under part of his body protruded through the seat of the chair towards the floor. Le Chiffre nodded to the thin man, who quietly left the room and closed the door. There was a packet of Gauloise on the table and a lighter. Le Chiffre lit a cigarette and swallowed a mouthful of coffee from the glass. Then he picked up the cane carpet beater and, resting the handle comfortably on his knee, allowed the flat trefoil base to lie on the floor directly under Bond's chair. He looked Bond carefully, almost caressingly, in the eyes. Then his wrist sprang suddenly upwards on his knee. The result was startling. Bond's whole body arched in an involuntary spasm. His face contracted in a soundless scream, and his lips drew right away from his teeth. At the same time, his head flew back with a jerk, showing the taut sinews of his neck. For an instant, muscles stood out in knots all over his body, and his toes and fingers clenched until they were quite white. Then his body sagged, and perspiration started to bead all over his body. He uttered a deep groan. Le Chiffre waited for his eyes to open.
"You see, dear boy,"
he smiled a soft, fat smile,
"is the position quite clear now?"
A drop of sweat fell off Bond's chin onto his naked chest.
"Now let us get down to business and see how soon we can be finished with this unfortunate mess you've got yourself into."
He puffed cheerfully at his cigarette and gave an admonitory tap on the floor beneath Bond's chair with his horrible and incongruous instrument.
"My dear boy,"
Le Chiffre spoke like a father,
"the game of Red Indians is over, quite over. You have stumbled by mischance into a game for grown-ups, and you have already found it a painful experience. You are not equipped, my dear boy, to play games with adults, and it was very foolish of your nanny in London to have sent you out here with your spade and bucket. Very foolish indeed, and most unfortunate for you. But we must stop joking, my dear fellow, although I am sure you would like to follow me in developing this amusing little cautionary tale."
He suddenly dropped his bantering tone and looked at Bond sharply and venomously.
"Where is the money?"
Bond's bloodshot eyes looked emptily back at him. Again the upward jerk of the wrist, and again Bond's whole body writhed and contorted. Le Chiffre waited until the tortured heart eased down its laboured pumping, and until Bond's eyes dully opened again.
"Perhaps I should explain," said Le Chiffre. "I intend to continue attacking the sensitive parts of your body until you answer my question. I am without mercy, and there will be no relenting. There is no one to stage a last-minute rescue, and there is no possibility of escape for you. This is not a romantic adventure story in which the villain is finally routed and the hero is given a medal and marries the girl. Unfortunately, these things don't happen in real life. If you continue to be obstinate,
You will be tortured to the edge of madness, and then the girl will be brought in, and we will set about her in front of you. If that is still not enough, you will both be painfully killed, and I shall reluctantly leave your bodies and make my way abroad to a comfortable house which is waiting for me. There I shall take up a useful and profitable career, and live to a ripe and peaceful old age in the bosom of the family I shall doubtless create. So you see, my dear boy, that I stand to lose nothing. If you hand the money over, so much the better. If not, I shall shrug my shoulders and be on my way.
He paused, and his wrist lifted slightly on his knee. Bond's flesh cringed as the cane's surface just touched him.
But you, my dear fellow, can only hope that I shall spare you further pain and spare your life. There is no other hope for you but that. Absolutely none. Well?
Bond closed his eyes and waited for the pain. He knew that the beginning of torture is the worst. There is a parabola of agony, a crescendo leading up to a peak, and then the nerves are blunted and react progressively less until unconsciousness and death. All he could do was to pray for the peak, pray that his spirit would hold out so long, and then accept the long free wheel down to the final blackout. He had been told by colleagues who had survived torture by the Germans and the Japanese that towards the end there came a wonderful period of warmth and languor, leading into a sort of sexual twilight, where pain turned to pleasure, and where hatred and fear of the torturers turned to a masochistic infatuation. It was the supreme test of will, he had learnt, to avoid showing this form of punch drunkenness. Directly it was suspected, they would either kill you at once and save themselves further useless effort, or let you recover sufficiently so that your nerves had crept back to the other side of the parabola. Then they would start again. He opened his eyes a fraction. Le Chiffre had been waiting for this, and like a rattlesnake the cane instrument leapt from the floor. It struck again and again, so that Bond screamed and his body jangled in the chair like a marionette. Le Chiffre desisted only when Bond's tortured spasms showed a trace of sluggishness. He sat for a while sipping his coffee and frowning slightly like a surgeon watching a cardiograph during a difficult operation. When Bond's eyes flickered and opened, he addressed him again, but now with a trace of impatience.
"We know that the money is somewhere in your room," he said. "You drew a cheque to cash for 40 million francs, and I know that you went back to the hotel to hide it."
For a moment Bond wondered how he had been so certain.
"Directly you left for the nightclub," continued Le Chiffre, "your room was searched by 4 of my people."
The Munces must have helped, reflected Bond.
"We found a good deal in childish hiding places. The ballcock in the lavatory yielded an interesting little code book, and we found some more of your papers taped to the back of a drawer. All the furniture has been taken to pieces, and your clothes and the curtains and bedclothes have been cut up. Every inch of the room has been searched, and all the fittings removed. It is most unfortunate for you that we didn't find the check. If we had, you would now be comfortably in bed, perhaps with the beautiful Miss Lind, instead of this."
He lashed upwards. Through the red mist of pain, Bond thought of Vesper. He could imagine how she was being used by the 2 gunmen. They would be making the most of her before she was sent for by Le Chiffre. He thought of the fat, wet lips of the Corsican and the slow cruelty of the thin man. Poor wretch to have been dragged into this. Poor little beast. Le Chiffre was talking again.
"Torture is a terrible thing," he was saying as he puffed at a fresh cigarette. "But it is a simple matter for the torturer, particularly when the patient," he smiled at the word, "is a man. You see, my dear Bond, with a man it is quite unnecessary to indulge in refinements. with this simple instrument, or with almost any other object, one can cause a man as much pain as is possible or necessary. Do not believe what you read in novels or books about the war. There is nothing worse. It is not only the immediate agony, but also the thought that your manhood is being gradually destroyed, and that at the end, if you will not yield, you will no longer be a man. That, my dear Bond, is a sad and terrible thought, a long chain of agony for the body and also for the mind, and then the final screaming moment when you will beg me to kill you. All that is inevitable, unless you tell me where you hid the money.
He poured some more coffee into the glass and drank it down, leaving brown corners to his mouth. Bond's lips were writhing. He was trying to say something. At last he got the word out in a harsh croak. "Drink," he said, and his tongue came out and swilled across his dry lips.
"Of course, my dear boy. How thoughtless of me."
Lechiffre poured some coffee into the other glass. There was a ring of sweat drops on the floor round Bond's chair.
"We must certainly keep your tongue lubricated."
He laid the handle of the carpet beater down on the floor between his thick legs and rose from his chair. He went behind Bond, and taking a handful of his soaking hair in one hand, he wrenched Bond's head sharply back. He poured the coffee down Bond's throat in small mouthfuls so that he would not choke. Then he released his head so that it fell forward again on his chest. He went back to his chair and picked up the carpet beater. Bond raised his head and spoke thickly.
"Money no good to you."
His voice was a laborious croak.
"Police trace it to you."
Exhausted by the effort, his head sank forward again. He was a little, but only a little, exaggerating the extent of his physical collapse. Anything to gain time, and anything to defer the next searing pain.
"Ah, my dear fellow, I'd forgotten to tell you."
Lechiffre smiled wolfishly.
"We met after our little game at the casino, and you were such a sportsman that you agreed we would have one more run through the pack between the two of us. It was a gallant gesture, typical of an English gentleman. Unfortunately, you lost, and this upset you so much that you decided to leave Royale immediately for an unknown destination. Like the gentleman you are, you very kindly gave me a note explaining the circumstances so that I would have no difficulty in cashing your check. You see, dear boy, everything has been thought of, and you need have no fears on my account."
He chuckled fatly.
"Now shall we continue? I have all the time in the world, and truth to tell, I am rather interested to see how long a man can stand this particular form of encouragement."
He rattled the harsh cane on the floor. So that was the score, thought Bond, with a final sinking of the heart. The unknown destination would be under the ground, or under the sea, or perhaps, more simply, under the crashed Bentley. Well, if he had to die anyway, he might as well try it the hard way. He had no hope that Matisse or Leiter would get to him in time, but at least there was a chance that they would catch up with Lechiffre before he could get away. It must be getting on for 7. The car might have been found by now. It was a choice of evils, but the longer Lechiffre continued the torture, the more likely he would be revenged. Bond lifted his head and looked Lechiffre in the eyes. The china of the whites was now veined with red. It was like looking at 2 blackcurrants poached in blood. The rest of the wide face was yellowish, except where a thick black stubble covered the moist skin. The upward edges of black coffee at the corners of the mouth gave his expression a false smile, and the whole face was faintly striped by the light through the Venetian blinds.
"No," he said flatly.
"Damn you!"
Le Chief grunted and set to work again with savage fury. Occasionally he snarled like a wild beast. After 10 minutes, Bond had fainted, blessedly. Le Chief at once stopped. He wiped some sweat from his face with a circular motion of his disengaged hand. Then he looked at his watch and seemed to make up his mind. He got up and stood behind the inert, dripping body. There was no colour in Bond's face or anywhere on his body above the waist. There was a faint flutter of his skin above the heart. Otherwise, he might have been dead. Le Chief seized Bond's ears and harshly twisted them. Then he leant forward and slapped his cheeks hard several times. Bond's head rolled from side to side with each blow. Slowly, his breathing became deeper. An animal groan came from his lolling mouth. Le Chief took a glass of coffee and poured some into Bond's mouth and threw the rest in his face. Bond's eyes slowly opened. Le Chief returned to his chair and waited. He lit a cigarette and contemplated the spattered pool of blood on the floor beneath the inert body opposite. Bond groaned again pitifully. It was an inhuman sound. His eyes opened and he gazed dully at his torturer. Le Chief spoke.
"That is all, Bond. We will now finish with you. You understand? Not kill you, but finish with you. And then we will have in the girl and see if something can be got out of the remains of the two of you."
He reached towards the table.
"Say goodbye to it, Bond."
Chapter 18. A crag-like face. It was extraordinary to hear the third voice. The hour's ritual had only demanded a duologue against the horrible noise of the torture. Bond's dimmed senses hardly took it in. Then, suddenly, he was halfway back to consciousness. He found he could see and hear again. He could hear the dead silence after the one quiet word from the doorway. He could see Le Chief's head slowly come up and the expression of blank astonishment, of innocent amazement, slowly give way to fear.
"Stop," had said the voice quietly.
Bond heard slow steps approaching behind his chair.
"Drop it," said the voice.
Bond saw Le Chief's hand open obediently and the knife fall with a clatter to the floor. He tried desperately to read into Le Chief's face what was happening behind him, but all he saw was blind incomprehension and terror. Le Chief's mouth worked, but only a high-pitched eek came from it. His heavy cheeks trembled as he tried to collect enough saliva in his mouth to say something, ask something. His hands fluttered vaguely in his lap. One of them made a slight movement towards his pocket, but instantly fell back. His round, staring eyes had lowered for a split second, and Bond guessed there was a gun trained on him. There was a moment's silence.
"Smash."
The word came almost with a sigh. It came with a downward cadence, as if nothing else had to be said. It was the final explanation, the last word of all.
"No," said Le Chief. "No, I..."
His voice tailed off. Perhaps he was going to explain, to apologize. But what he must have seen in the other's face made it all useless.
"You're two men, both dead. You are a fool and a thief and a traitor. I have been sent from the Soviet Union to eliminate you. You are fortunate that I have only time to shoot you. If it was possible, I was instructed that you should die most painfully. We cannot see the end of the trouble you have caused."
The thick voice stopped. There was silence in the room save for the rasping breath of Le Chief. Somewhere outside, a bird began to sing, and there were other small noises from the awakening countryside. The bands of sunlight were stronger, and the sweat on Le Chief's face glistened brightly.
"Do you plead guilty?"
Bond wrestled with his consciousness. He screwed up his eyes and tried to shake his head to clear it, but his whole nervous system was numbed, and no message was transmitted to his muscles. He could just keep his focus on the great pale face in front of him, and on its bulging eyes. A thin string of saliva crept from the open mouth and hung down from the chin.
Yes, said the mouth. There was a sharp phut, no louder than a bubble of air escaping from a tube of toothpaste. No other noise at all. And suddenly Le Chiffre had grown another eye, a third eye on a level with the other two, right where the thick nose started to jut out below the forehead. It was a small black eye, without eyelashes or eyebrows. For a second the three eyes looked out across the room, and then the whole face seemed to slip and go down on one knee. The two outer eyes turned, trembling up towards the ceiling. Then the heavy head fell sideways, and the right shoulder, and finally the whole upper part of the body lurched over the arm of the chair.